April is National Autism Awareness Month and the calendar home of the environmental holiday Earth Day. In today's Writer's Voice, we feature segments dealing with both those themes. First, we talk about Asperger Syndrome with John Elder Robison. His book is Be Different.
Those of us who are different need to embrace the idea that our differences, while they may set us apart from other people, may also be the key to our success. You know, the world needs people who are different and not everyone the same. And so it's sort of a celebration of that.
Then Tony Sorgi tells us about the New Earth Archive, a curated list of books to guide us through the environmental and social crises facing us.
When I first broached this concept, it was pretty much just to my friends who, you know, a few of them are in the course with me. And it kind of resonated, you know? They said, yeah, this is cool. We'd like to check out some of these books and see what we can do.
And finally, we hear an encore interview from the author of one of the books on the New Earth Archive list, Paul Hawken. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When we first talked with John Elder Robison in 2008, he'd recently come out with his memoir of living with Asperger syndrome, Look Me in the Eye. With its quirky humor, that book became a bestseller. It's also been one of the most popular Writer's Voice interviews on our website. Now, Robison has come out with a second book, Be Different, a guide filled with wonderful stories offering practical advice for, as the subtitle says, Aspergians, misfits, families, and teachers. Be Different celebrates the gifts that Asperger's brings while recounting how Robison overcame its disabilities to build a successful life and career. John Elder Robison was the sound advisor for the bands Kiss and Pink Floyd, for whom he created their signature illuminated, fire-breathing, and rocket-launching guitars. He founded a specialty car repair shop servicing Rolls-Royces and Bentleys as well as other luxury vehicles. And he's also the brother of author Augustine Burroughs. I spoke with John Elder Robison at his home in Amherst, Massachusetts, in March. John Elder Robison, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me on with you today.
Be Different is the name of your book, which I really loved that title. It, in two words, packs an awful lot of meaning into it. Be Different, it's a very assertive statement. A positive statement. Say a little bit about it.
Well, I think that those of us who are different need to embrace the idea that our differences, while they may set us apart from other people, may also be the key to our success. You know, the world needs people who are different and not everyone the same. And so it's sort of a celebration of that.
A celebration indeed. You talk in it both of the upsides and the downsides. And I'd like to actually start out with some of the upsides, some of the things, the gifts that you feel that having Asperger's has brought for you.
Well, it's not as simple as saying which things are gifts and which are not. Really, every trait of autism, of which Asperger's is a subset, could affect me at one time in a disabling way, and in another time it could affect me in a gifted way. For example, my social disability, my inability to read the expressions of other people, caused me to be isolated and lonely as a little boy. But when I got older, my isolation was what made it possible for me to concentrate on my great technical loves, music and electronics. And if I'd been a socially skilled kid, I'd have been out playing with my friends, but I wasn't. So I spent thousands and thousands of hours studying electronics, and the thing that made me alone made me gifted in electronics a few years later. And that's a good example of how a trait can affect you both ways.
And there are even ways in some of those traits, for example, where you talk about music and being able to just intuitively, it seems, understand what, well, first of all, explain a little bit what you did do with music and electronics.
I made sound effects. I made things that made sounds out of nothing. I made devices that transformed sounds, made things sound like they were falling through space or twisting or turning or doing different things. And then I made pieces that were at the heart of sound systems to deliver the music to the audience in a live performance situation. I also made visual special effects. The things I'm most well known for in that area are all the guitars that Kiss played that shot fire, shot rockets, lit up, exploded, and did stuff like that in the 70s.
Sounds like fun.
I think it was fun. Yeah, I had a good time doing that. Yeah, it was.
And you talked in your memoir, Look Me in the Eye, you described the unique vision that you were able to have that enabled you to do some of that, and you ascribed some of that to the Aspergers. Could you explain a little bit of that?
Well, what I describe in my books is how I taught myself the relationship between a sound I heard and how the pattern that sound would make on an oscilloscope screen looked. And then I taught myself how different circuits would change that pattern, and then what the resultant different pattern would sound like. Now, you sort of said that I had a gift for doing that, and I think it's more accurate to say that I taught myself to do that through countless hours of practice. I wasn't natural born with the ability to do that. I taught myself. And that's why I say that this isn't so much an example of unusual one in a million genius. It's an example of a kid who was in his own world, and being in my own world, I concentrated on the things I really loved, and I just got good at it by dint of practice.
You divide the world into three different groups of people. You have those who have Asperger's, you have those who are proto-Aspergians, and those who are neurotypicals or nigh-typicals, that is, the normals. Could you say a little bit more about, well, I think we know a little bit about Asperger's, but actually, you know, I think it would not be a bad idea to give a kind of very brief version of, you know, the general description of Asperger's syndrome.
Asperger's is one of the conditions that make up the autism spectrum. Autism is described clinically as a communication disorder. Some people with autism have trouble speaking language or understanding spoken language. Other people, the Asperger group, tend to have good language skills, but they have difficulty reading the unspoken cues from other people. And the thing is, the unspoken part of a conversation carries much of the meaning. It's what tells you, I'm happy, I'm laughing at you, I think that you're great, I think that you're really obnoxious, I really want this a lot, or I really don't want it at all. And if you can't get those messages, you're functionally crippled. So Asperger people are the people on the autism spectrum who tend to have social disability, where they can comprehend language, but they can't comprehend the nonverbal part, where the traditional autism, you have difficulty with language. Mm-hmm. And it's all a continuum. There are some people who have tremendous trouble with language who don't talk at all. Then there are people who have a lot of trouble who get therapy, and by the time they're 25 years old, you can't tell them from anyone else. And there are people who are touched by that very slightly, but not so much as to ever be diagnosed as disabled. And those people who have a touch of autism or Asperger's are the people I call proto-Aspergians. There are millions of people like that in schools and out in the working world where they have eccentric traits, but at no time were they really ever crippled by it.
And then there are the neurotypicals.
Right. Some people would call that normal, but I don't think it really is normal. I think that they're the people who aren't touched by autism in any way. And clinically, they call those folks neurotypicals, and I contract that to nypicals. Whether those are 90% of the population or 95% of the population, we don't really know. People with an autism diagnosis, we believe, make up about 1% of the population. The proto-Aspergian population, that could be 2, 3, 4, 5 more percent of the population. And the nypicals are the rest.
How old were you when you first found out that you had this thing called Asperger's syndrome?
I learned about Asperger's and myself in the mid-1990s when I was 40 years old, and that was coincidentally just a couple of years after Asperger's entered the DSM, which is the manual psychiatrists and psychologists use for diagnosis.
We're talking with John Elder Robison about his latest book, Be Different, Adventures of a Free-Range Aspergian, with practical advice for Aspergians, misfits, families, and teachers. And what was your feeling when you did find that out?
Well, it was really a great relief for me because I had lived all my life thinking that I was defective. It was obvious to me that I failed socially when other people around me visibly succeeded. And yet, I didn't think I was dumb. I thought that I had a good ability to learn things. I knew a lot of useful stuff. I had been commercially successful, but I was always a social failure, and I assumed I was defective in some way I didn't understand. So when I learned about Asperger's and I realized it wasn't just me and I wasn't just defective, but I was different in these certain specific ways, that was a really big deal to me because when I understood what was different about myself, I could set about changing and adapting and learning how to fit in and be more successful. And that's the essence of what this book's about.
And in this book, Be Different, you tell a lot of the techniques that you use. One of the first things you did is you went to read Emily Post's book, Manners.
Well, if you look at these two books of mine that are out there, Look Me in the Eye is kind of entertaining stories that show how I had an unusual life because I was different. Be Different is the how-to guide to that. People would read Look Me in the Eye and they would say, you know, I wish you could explain these things better because on this page in your book you say, I decided I needed a real job and then I turn the page and there you are working at Milton Bradley and I want to know how to do that. And so when I wrote Be Different, what I resolved to do is take every trait in the DSM manual that's associated with autism or Asperger's and come up with some sort of a stupid story of my life that illustrated how that trait affected me. And sometimes it affects me in ways that are funny, and sometimes it's serious, and sometimes I'm gifted by it, and sometimes I'm disabled. So it could be everything. But I really tried to describe how I dealt with all the ways in which autism affects me while still telling entertaining stories which people loved and looked me in the eye.
One of the ones that really struck me so much, how you were actually, you know, people accused you of being a sociopath. People thought that you didn't care about them. And, you know, you were just left dumbfounded because you knew you really did care. And talk about, you know, that whole issue of kind of being seen as being incredibly self-centered. Why does that happen with Asperger's?
Well, if your ability to perceive the feelings of other people is limited, then your ability to respond to their feelings is going to be either limited or perhaps just non-existent. If you're looking at me and you're thinking, I'm really upset, and you're standing there looking at me thinking more and more, I'm really upset, and you keep thinking it, and eventually you start getting, you know, pissed. You're thinking, he's not even paying any attention to me. That's the nature of autism or Asperger's. We don't perceive those unspoken signals from you. So while you're there getting more upset and more agitated, we have no idea any of that's going on. Mm-hmm. Now, a person with Asperger's with good language skills could get what you say if you say, John, I'm really upset. And I would say, really? Why? But you see, I wouldn't feel you're upset. I would hear your words, but hearing your words wouldn't make me upset. Whereas a person who wasn't touched by autism, and you see people have these exchanges all the time, you would come up to your friend and you'd be really upset and your friend would say, oh, that's awful. And the two of you would be almost like crying together about this situation that had distressed you. And that wouldn't happen with somebody like me. If you came up to me and you made those expressions, I wouldn't really respond at all. And if you said, John, I'm really upset, I would say, really? Why? And I would listen to you, but it wouldn't necessarily make me upset. Mm-hmm. And that's the nature of my communication impairment. I can't get feelings from you. I can hear the words and I can understand that you're upset, but it doesn't make me feel the same way.
And yet here's one of the places where where the gift of this disability comes out when you talk about how people who have Asperger's can be excellent in a crisis, who are often really, really good as emergency responders.
Well, yeah, you could be really good in an emergency situation when everyone was paralyzed by shock or horror or fear. But even in a more ordinary situation, you could be at work and you could just be so upset and you could say, I just can't believe he said that to me, and I'm going to sue and I'm going to quit and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And somebody like me, I would listen to those words and I would say, well, you know, maybe that's more than is really warranted. And I could just give you a logical interpretation of the situation. And a lot of times that leads to a better outcome if you're guided by logic. And I think if we return to the example of Mr. Spock on Star Trek, that's why Spock was so good to have around, because when people are carried away by emotion, there's great value in having a logical thinker there.
But what about your own feelings? I mean, you're not really saying that people who have Asperger's don't get carried away by their own feelings of, say, rage or sadness. I mean, you feel just as much as anybody else, don't you?
That's right. Yeah, I can get upset and enraged, or I could be happy, sad, angry, jealous. I could be any of those things. But the point is that I would get that way from what happened to me. So if I thought my mother was really sick, I would be really upset. But if you just walked up to me and you said, I'm really angry, that wouldn't make me angry at all. Now, if you and I experienced something together and it made you angry, it might make me angry and it might not. And that's the time, I think, when a person like me can have an advantage, because if we both experience something, but it doesn't make me upset and it makes you upset and I can see it for what it is logically, then I can offer a different point of view that might be more constructive. That doesn't mean that I don't have emotions or feelings. It just means that the things that trigger certain reactions in nypical people don't trigger those reactions in people on the spectrum, on the autism spectrum.
We're talking with John Elder Robison about his book, Be Different. It's a guide for people who have Asperger's and his advice for fellow Aspergians, misfits, families, and teachers. There was an example that stood out for me where you might go, for example, into a room where somebody was watching a television program, and you would just change it. Explain what's going on there.
Well, that's, again, an example of being oblivious to the feelings of other people. If you're not sensitive to what other people are thinking and feeling, sometimes you don't even think that other people are around. So you walk into a room and you think, that Discovery Channel show about ships is on, and I want to see that, and you pick up the remote and you turn it on. And it doesn't even occur to you that somebody else was like sitting there watching Seinfeld or something, and they get all upset. And so the other people in the room, they might think, you know, how can you do that? And how can you be so inconsiderate? And how can you be so obnoxious? And you're not any of those things. It didn't occur to you that they were there. And so then you say, well, I didn't realize you were there. And they get even more upset because you're just completely ignoring us and disregarding us and we don't mean anything to you. And that's not true. It just means that at that moment, you were in your own world and you were having these thoughts and that's what you thought of, and it didn't include them. Yeah. And that's, again, that's an example of how that trait is disabling. Being in your own world and allowing you to concentrate deeply, that can be a key to unlocking creative genius and concentrating and doing things other people can't do. But it can also be something that isolates you from other people and gets them really upset with you because they think you're belittling them or dismissing them, when in fact you're just in your own world.
So do you think that having Asperger's and also you mentioned that some people who have ADHD also can relate to this. So this isn't just Asperger's, but it may encompass more issues of the same ilk.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I think there are millions of people who are different like that. And In a college community like where we live here, there are many, many people in on the technical faculty of all of these schools and many students in technical and scientific pursuits in the schools. And we have thousands of geeks just right here in town that I think can relate to this.
Mm-hmm. So you also talk about being hypersensitive, about sensory overload. I wonder if you could explain a little bit about that and how that affected you as a child and how you managed to manage that as an adult.
I guess I've managed it through long practice. Sometimes people would come up to me at speaking events and they would say, "You're up there in the middle of winter and you're talking to us in a wool sweater, and you must be like a fake autistic person, because my kid has autism and he could never wear wool." And in the Be Different book, I actually have a chapter that speaks to those people. It's called Underwear with Teeth. And indeed, I am affected by that. The nature of the sensory thing, and again, this shows how it can be a gift or a disability. You can maybe hear all this stuff around you, and you hear more things than typical people hear, just like a dog, you know, like a dog smells this world that's concealed to us humans. And we may hear or see more in light and sound. And if we are overloaded and non-functional, that's an example of how it's crippling to us. If we hear everything, though, and we devote our lives to music, and we become, for example, a conductor of a symphony, it takes that kind of Asperger focus and sensory sensitivity to stand in front of 100 musicians and listen to just that violin and just that cello and give those people specific instructions as you have singled out their playing amid 100 other people all playing at the same time. So that is an extraordinary gift. And am I saying there that every symphony conductor has Asperger's? No, I'm not. But what I am saying is that the better a symphony conductor is, the farther out on the geek spectrum he is. Mm-hmm. And what you're going to see is that they would be, many of them, good examples of proto-Aspergian people, where they're not necessarily disabled by autism, but they have autistic traits like sensory sensitivity, and they are significantly different because of those traits than the majority of other people.
In Be Different, John Elder Robison says because he had a hard time processing information from others, teachers, for example, he had to figure out things for himself. He had to invent his own solutions.
And as long as you're someone who has the ability to do that, then it's once again a disability trait that turns into a gift. If you think differently from everyone else, you don't have to be a genius to invent things. If you're in a room with 100 people and 99 of them were trained and educated to do a certain thing and solve a certain problem in a certain way, and their attempts to solve the problem all in the same way lead to failure, you, who were not trainable in that way and who learned it in your own way, and maybe your way is less efficient and maybe it's even stupid seeming to other people, but your way may in that case lead to a totally different solution, which in that circumstance works. Mm-hmm. So you did something that the 99 other people failed to do, and they look to you as a great inventor, when in fact you did the same thing that they tried to do. It's just that in that particular circumstance, you succeeded and they failed. And the funny thing about that is that they may succeed at things more than you 99 times out of 100. But when people who are the same succeed at the same thing, they take it for granted, right? It becomes, we can all do this and it's easy. If you're the person who can do the things no one else can do, by virtue of your difference, you are exceptional. And it almost doesn't matter that you be exceptionally smart. You just have to be different and able to apply that reasoning.
I wonder if you could also talk a little bit about the emotional toll of having been different. And I'm thinking growing up as a child. I mean, you had a tough road to hoe growing up anyway. This has been recounted in the books of your brother, Augustine Burroughs. Things were not easy at home. But you had this added burden. Even after you found out that you had Asperger's and you had that great sense of relief, have you had struggles with dealing with the kind of emotional fallout of having grown up with so much misunderstanding?
Well, sure. I've had trouble with loneliness and sort of skirting the edge of depression, and I've had difficulty with relationships of all kinds all my life because my ability to read the signals from other people is very limited. And that absolutely, as successful as I've been on other fronts, it's a serious handicap there still. And I guess all I can really say is that, you can't have everything, right? I mean, there's stuff that I can do that is sort of exceptional, but that's something that I'm not as good at as many people. And I am conscious of being alone in many ways all the time.
Do you have some advice for people maybe who are in high school or even still in college or even in elementary school, the parents thereof, who are going through who are being bullied because they exhibit these traits?
You know, when I had those Discovery Channel people here to do a TV thing about me, I brought them over to the junior high. Now it's called Amherst Middle School, and I showed them where I dealt firmly and positively with my bully problem in the Lobster Claws chapter of this book. And they all liked that, but you know, you can't solve your bully problems with pliers today.
Do you want to briefly say what that was, what happened?
Well, no, the book's on sale. They can go buy the damn book and see what it is themselves. But what I would say is that really for young people, I remember how life, it just sucked for me. It was awful. I didn't have friends. I was alone. I was lost. I felt like I could be attacked every time I turned around in the cafeteria or the corridors of school, and people ridiculed me for the things that I loved. And I learned by the time I was 30 that the things they ridiculed me for made me a star, and nobody else could do those things. And they're what made me commercially successful, and I ended up better off than 90% of my classmates in school in many ways. And what I would say to young people is that school is a very artificial environment. And for people like us who are different, the very things that get us ridiculed as kids can make us superstars as grownups. And I would just look forward to brighter days when you're grinding your way through school.
And speaking of young people, you have a son, Cubby, who also has Asperger's. What would you say about differences in the world with respect to understanding of Asperger's that he's growing up in and the world that you did?
Well, I think there's somewhat more understanding, but I don't think there's a lot of difference in how you get along, because your success dealing with other children on the playground is not affected in any way by professionals' awareness of autism and Asperger's in a manual. You're still one-on-one with another five-year-old in a sandbox or on a swing set. And I don't think that's changed. I think that being aware allowed me to give my son actionable advice so that he could be more successful. And I think he has been more successful. You know, I was very proud that the day after Christmas last year, December 26th, my son and his girlfriend, who also has Asperger's, were the whole front page of the New York Times. And there's a story called Navigating Love and Autism that talks about them. And I just was so proud of them that at age 22, the kids were out there telling stories like that about personal topics really expressly to help younger people who are following in their footsteps. And I certainly wasn't able to think about that when I was 22, and I'm really touched to see that. And anyone who wants to read that story, you can go to the New York Times website and just type in Navigating Love and Autism.
That was a really wonderful story. And one of the things that struck me is, you know, they were very proud of who they were. I mean, not just that you're proud of them, but they didn't feel that they were in any way really less than anybody else.
No, I don't think they feel defective like I did. That's the beauty of understanding why you're different. Because if you don't know why you're different, but you're less successful at something, what can you conclude except you're just not as good? But if you understand from an early age that you're different and there's some constructive, you know, description about how you're different, then you don't feel bad about yourself. And I think that's a powerful thing.
Well, John Elder Robison, your book is Be Different, My Adventures with Asperger's and My Advice for Fellow Aspergians, Misfits, Families, and Teachers. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Woof.
You can find a link to John Elder Robison's blog at writersvoice.net. And you can listen to Writer's Voice anytime you want by subscribing to our free podcast. Just go to writersvoice.net to sign up. Next up, we talk to Anthony Sorge, whose New Earth Archive was recently featured in the New York Times. Stay tuned after the break.
Left like ink upon a page, untouched by years, unbrushed by age. A breath of light that will not disappear. And each will make their own true mark to leave this world a bit less dark. A sweet refrain that tells us they were here. And the willow bends and the willow breaks. It does not last forever. The summers come and the summers pass. But there's something never ending in a heartprint shadow. Every soul must find its mate before the herb becomes too late. A fader light that will not steal September. And every grain of sand alone was once a great and a mighty stone. Turned by time, but the ocean she remembers.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. What if you were a book lover and a young person who cares deeply about the planet you're going to inherit? You might want to create a kind of archive that could also be an ark to help humans negotiate the treacherous rapids of the century's environmental crises. If you were engineering student Anthony Sorge, you would found a project called the New Earth Archive and crowdsource a master list of books and other resources to be that ark. The New Earth Archive is a web-based resource for college students and the general public that identifies the most powerful and influential books written about such topics as climate change, sociology, ecology, economics, technology, philosophy, and others to inspire readers to change the world, as its website says. Anthony Sorge is a student at the New Jersey Institute of Technology's Albert Dorman Honors College, where he'll graduate in May with a degree in engineering. Tony Sorge, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me here.
Your project, the New Earth Archive, it's built as a resource network that seeks to identify the most inspiring books on climate change, sustainability, and social change, as well as revelations in understanding human nature. First, tell us, how did you get this wonderful idea?
Well, there was more than a few things that contributed to it. I definitely give NJIT's STS department a thumbs up on this one. It's their Science, Technology, and Sustainability department. And I took a few courses during my undergraduate degree that really, I think, opened my eyes is a bit cliche, but I mean, pretty much served that effect. I'd say it really showed me how unaware of much of what happens, whether it's in our nation or our planet, is most college students seem to be, including myself. And I realized that that needs to change. Second was how much I see reading levels decline, and not just in students my own age. I have the amazing privilege to have a younger brother right now. He's 7, and he means the world to me. But I get to see firsthand kind of what the sort of differences in our generation are, which, you know, between 7 and 22, I think is definitely a different generation.
So how does the New Earth Archive work?
Well, how I built it and how I envision it to work, I think, are slightly different processes. What I went about doing to start was I went to some of my professors in the STS department, and I said, you know, I know there's books out there that really do their best to address these issues, and I need ideas for what these books are. And they gave me some ideas, but more importantly, they connected me to some incredible people that are, you know, working in all these fields. And I have to say, I have to give David Rothenberg a huge thanks here. He's one of the professors. I took a music and technology course with him, and I had no idea he was as incredibly well-connected as he was, but he hooked me up with a bunch of people at the Garrison Institute's Climate, Mind, and Behavior Project, and I did the same thing. I asked them for ideas, and they just flooded me with over 400 different suggestions. I was overwhelmed. It was an incredible amount of books. So I realized I needed a way to streamline these into, you know, a compact resource that would be appealing to students, right? Because that was what I started this whole thing as. I need to identify the books that have the ability to educate and empower students to drive change.
And why books? I mean, we hear these days so much that you know, people are just glued to their screens, that books are going the way of the dodo. Why books?
Because I think books have an incredible ability to really shape the way we have conversations today. And I see the lack of reading manifesting in the loss of this ability to have conversations. And I mean that in three ways. I mean that with each other. I mean that with the environment and government and culture. And I mean that with ourselves. And I think reading and just the physical act of sitting down, either turning a page or using an ebook, just sitting and absorbing a message and either taking notes or reflecting on it, it really sticks with you in a way that, you know, a message on a screen often doesn't. Books stick with you, and the fact that you have to go slow and really think about what's on the page has a level of impact, I think, in really helping you understand yourself. You know, reading was a huge part of my life, and I think that's why I have this strong personal bias towards it. And, you know, whether it was fiction, comics, science fiction, you know, nonfiction, history, literature, I think all of it played a huge part in showing me my own strengths, my weaknesses, and what motivated me. You know, it helped lead me to understand how I should put my career to use, and not just to pursue a career, not just to find a means to an income.
You know, it's so exciting for a book lover like myself to hear you talk this way and about probably the most important issue facing humanity at this time and maybe for all time. And that is the issue of climate change, sustainability, and the social change that we're going to need to get there. You've had a tremendous reaction to this project. Is that correct?
It is. It's been an incredible, you know, enthusiastic and confidence-building response, I'd say, just from both people at NJIT, my professors, people willing to help us buy some of these books, and, you know, the online and literary community. People like yourself and, you know, Andrew Revkin at the New York Times helped me out with that blog post. It's been pretty incredible. I've managed to attract the ear and meet some really amazing and influential people out there. You know, I have to give an incredible thanks to Paul Hawken, who I, you know, heard about this through the Garrison Institute CMB and has just been an enormous supporter, both in reaching out to others and helping me choose books. And I say, when I first saw an email from him, you know, back in December, I couldn't believe it. And now I'm seeing emails from people like David Orr and Stuart Brand even. And I'm just like, some of the authors of the books that are on this list, I see it and it just doesn't seem possible.
Yeah, Stuart Brand, who started the Whole Earth Catalog way back when I was a college student, and Paul Hawken, who wrote a wonderful book called Blessed Unrest. We've interviewed him about that. Actually, I've interviewed him about that for a different show that I used to produce. Paul Hawken, Blessed Unrest. This is a book about how social change, how people are already making the biggest movement in all of history, the movement of people toward sustainability and greater economic and social justice. Say a little bit about how your peers have reacted to this. I mean, you guys are going to be bearing an incredible burden of, inherit a terrible burden that my generation and older generations will have left you with. How are your peers relating to this project?
I think they're starting to see it as something positive and even necessary. When I first broached this concept, it was pretty much just to my friends who, a few of them are in the course with me, and a few of them, just this circle of friends that I've built. And it kind of resonated, They said, yeah, this is cool. We'd like to check out some of these books and see what we can do. And a few of them reached out to a few others, and they noticed some of our activity online on Facebook. And all of a sudden, I started getting messages on Facebook going, hey, this is so cool. I can't believe you guys are doing this. Like, I love reading. Right after the TED talk that I gave yesterday, the TEDx talk, a student came up to me that said, he introduced himself and he said, hey, this is my second year at NJIT. I haven't really done much on campus. I've never seen a TEDx talk or a TED talk before, and especially, actually been to one. But I love reading, and I came here and I was blown away by the fact that somebody else loved reading, and I don't understand people that don't. And thank you for doing this. I can't wait to see some of these books on campus and pick them up. And that was pretty amazing, after that whole night of just being stressed out for 2 weeks before, getting ready to give this talk, having that one kid come up and say, thank you, thanks for getting these books, and it's incredibly exciting to see that someone else loves reading as much as I do. That made my night.
That's great. And you have this process by which you're asking people, is it still open? You're asking people to vote on the 400 books on your list and even suggest new ones. How is that going? And are some top favorites already showing up?
Well, so let me clarify that, actually. When I had those 400 books, that was back in, late January. I had a small committee that helped me check out the patterns and the trends in people's suggestions, and we managed to identify the top 75. And then I made a ballot using Survey Gizmo and attached that to a website that I made to house all these suggestions. And that's what I started floating around on the internet through the Garrison Institute, through different communities in science and literature, and asked them to vote on it. And that's what's up there on the website right now, and that's what I've been gathering for the past couple of months. And we've gotten over 140 different voters and almost 1,500 individual votes. I just asked them to choose anywhere up to 15 that they thought would deserve to be on this streamlined list. And I could definitely share with you some of that have risen to the top of the list. You mentioned Blessed Unrest, and that's actually very high up there, and that's going to be definitely one of the books that NJIT purchases. A few others that have risen to the top is The Future of Life by E.O. Wilson, In Defense of Food by Michael Pollan. That has just been it's risen to the top of the list. A lot of people think that has a lot of impacts more than just, in how to eat, but definitely, in our social and consumer-based society, has some lessons there. And a few others, I'd say, Gus Speth's The Bridge at the Edge of the World. That's another one that people like. Store Brand's Whole Earth Discipline. And Thinking Fast and Slow by Dan Kahneman. And that really emphasizes the kind of points we're trying to get here. We need to look at this from a climate change, from, a political and public policy perspective, but also, an inward, introspective look at, how we think and how we make the decisions that we do.
Wow, that's an impressive list. Has this project, doing this, starting this, seeing the reaction, has it caused any shift in your own thoughts or feelings about the future?
It actually has. I'd say one of the courses I took early on, an environmental policy course, I honestly think could have been retitled 10 Reasons the Earth is Doomed, and there wasn't much of a positive impact. But through this project, through a few other courses, has given me an incredible sense of hopefulness for the future. I see so many different fields coming together, everything from climate scientists and economists, social psychologists, behavioral psychologists, neuroscientists, and their contributions, have really shown me that there's some pretty amazing work being done, and it's not just the technological advancements that's going to save us, but it's all these new, like I mentioned in the focus for the New Earth Archive, these revelations in understanding human nature. And the response for this project alone has given me a lot of confidence. Now I see an amazing ability for people to utilize some pretty amazing technology that we have now in order to come together and find this sense of connection and collectively work to overcome a lot of the really severe problems that we face.
Wow, that's wonderful. And we will link to your website at the New Earth Archive. Are you still taking votes?
Yeah, actually, if I can just plug that real quick. We're not taking votes for the 2012 list. That's been decided. NGIT is going to go out and purchase about 6 to 7 copies of the books and have them spread around campus. But starting now is the second phase of what I see this project as. I've managed to grab a few web techies, and we're going to go back and we're going to redesign the website into more of this social network that I envision. And from today forward, we're going to start accepting submissions for books that would people think should go on the next year's New Earth Archive. And from this point, we're going to see a constant reevaluation of the books that are on the archive. We're going to take ratings and feedback and try and get a sense for what books actually resonate with college students. And using that feedback and all the new submissions between now and December, I'll start to add those to the website. And next December, we'll hold a new vote for the 2013 list. And I hope this, turns into a constantly updating process that we start to see, what books truly do reach college students and even past that, maybe even high school students. What books really influence us to drive change? And hopefully we'll spread that out to films and other sorts of media as well.
Well, Tony Sorgi, I want to thank you so much for talking with us and also for doing this wonderful project, the New Earth Archive. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Anthony Sorgi will graduate in May from the New Jersey Institute of Technology with a degree in engineering. The New Earth Archive is raising funds to build a social media platform. To find out more about it and what's on its list of books, go to writersvoice.net. And next up, we air an encore interview with the author of one of the books on the list, Paul Hawken. The book is Blessed Unrest. Environmental activist and green economy imagineer Paul Hawken's book, Blessed Unrest, is about the explosive growth of the global movement for social and environmental justice. Hawken is one of the stars of the environmental movement, so he gives a lot of speeches. People come up to him all the time and press their business cards into his hand, cards from a myriad of grassroots organizations trying to change the world for the better. It dawned on him several years ago that there was a huge movement made up of all these small groups, and he decided to find out more about it.
It was just then that I began to wonder, really out of curiosity, how many organizations there were in the world dedicated to the environment and social justice. And having been raised in Berkeley, and my father taught library science at the university, I just assumed there was a list, and I could go look it up and, get the count. And what I discovered was that there really wasn't anything, both nationally and internationally. so I began to count myself, was what happened, sort of informally at first, and it became more and more formal until today it's quite formal. And as I did so, I began to realize that there was no other movement extant that is present in the world today that was this large. And then I began to research backwards and to see if there had ever been anything as large as this movement. Of course, it begs the next question, which, you know, which is why call it a movement. But if you stay ahead of that question for a minute, the number of organizations in the world that are dedicated to these issues is at least between 1 and 2 million, and it is also the fastest growing movement in the world. So that's really how the book arose, the title, and really the research, both into the past, into its history, and then speculations as to what it means.
Tell us a little bit about what this movement is. Describe it for us.
Well, it's comprised of people. It's a bottom-up movement. It's I say that it's a really huge shift in a world that has been created by privilege to a world created by community. Almost without exception, the organizations that comprise this movement consist of people who found themselves in the situation by default. In other words, they found pollution or destruction or an injustice or oppression, and they looked around to see who was addressing it, that is, which government or agency or institution, and found that there were none, and therefore then formed some sort of aggregation of people. So there's a huge variety of organizations all over the world. We tend to call them nonprofits or non-governmental organizations, but in fact, there are collectives, there are, you know, obviously foundations, there are educational institutions, there are activist NGOs, there are BINGOs, which is a big international NGOs that started this way as well, but have been around for longer and have, you know, memberships and chapters and big endowments in some cases. And so they run the whole gamut. But they all started by a small group of people addressing a local or regional issue.
Now, you refer to the bottom-up or grassroots nature of this movement, and that's really a pervasive theme in the book. You also say that it's not an anti-globalization movement. You
no.
say it's something different. Tell us. It is a globalization from below.
Yeah. I mean, it's an anti-corporatization of the environment movement. It's an anti-corporatization of the commons movement. But it actually is a manifestation of globalization, because the reason this movement is so large and growing so quickly is because of globalization, because of the ability of organizations around the world and within regions to network, connect, collaborate, communicate with each other, and share information. And this is what makes them effective, even though most organizations are small. Now, it is definitely questions the tenets of corporate globalization or economic fundamentalism, and that is what I make very clear in the book, this idea that somehow if you open up markets, it's an unabated benefit to people everywhere is questioned, I think, by virtually every group that is in this so-called movement. Yeah.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with author Paul Hawken about his book, Blessed Unrest. In Blessed Unrest, Hawken says the grassroots movement for environmental and social justice is like the planet's immune system. He explains where that metaphor came from.
It actually arose spontaneously in a speech I gave at Bioneers in 2004. And I just said it, and it sounded really good at the time. And so afterwards, I thought, maybe I better research this. When I wrote Blessed Unrest, I spent a lot of time researching the immune system, and it is so, so fascinating. And I realized that I was lucky on that one, that the metaphor works better the more you understand the immune system, not worse. And the interesting thing about immune systems are that we don't understand that well, first of all. Second, they're the most complex system in the body, more complicated than the brain, more differentiated, different types of cells than any other organ. What's interesting is that the immune system functions better, that is, it's more resilient when it is better networked. That is, the better networked the system, and it is a network, the more immune the organism is to invasive organisms, disease. So that was a real insight for me, because I realized that this movement is networked and getting better at it. It's not as nearly networked as it could be, I believe. But because of modern communication technology, cell phone, internet, email, etc., that you're seeing a real shift in this movement from being, in a sense, atomistic, that is to say, organizations scattered and distributed in different places all around the world, in different areas, not aware of each other, and you're starting to see this movement really getting hooked up. And as it gets hooked up, it gets much more powerful and effective than when it works by itself.
Could you give us an example of how a group or how this system, this movement functions in the immune system?
Seattle, which is, even though it was 8 years ago, I mean, Seattle is a case in point, which is where civil society around the world belled the cat of economic fundamentalism. I mean, that's really what happened in Seattle.
Oh, in Seattle.
Seattle, yeah. Seattle, the WTO protests in November 1999, November 30 starting December. But those protests, basically, who organized them? Who led them? Some people stand up and say they did, but they didn't. And the way it was organized, in both on the street and prior to the protests, was a perfect example of this sort of immune response. And after that, the WTO and constituent types of trade organizations were never able to meet again without those who were and are excluded from the deliberative processes being out there and making noise and insisting that they participate, insisting that the stakeholders of the world have a say in trade policy. And, you know, to this day, the Doha Round, literally the things that were in the 1999 proposals in Seattle have still not been adopted by the world, and that would not be true were it not for Seattle. So, but then the February 2003 protests against the invasion of Iraq by the coalition of the so-called willing, led by the United States, where 10 to 12 million people marched in the world. I mean, that's humanity's immune response. Again, say, I could say, well, yeah, but, you know, the war went on. Mm-hmm, it did. And but every time this happens now, it gets more and more powerful. And the connections that are made in these kinds of protests and demonstrations are not connections that are easily lost.
Paul Hawken is the author of Blessed Unrest. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to find out more about that book and also about the other books on the New Earth Archive. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.